A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast. Hi guys, we're back on episode number 2 of season 2, and I've got here James, the man that's going to help me get through the intros and outros.
Yep, so thanks for having me back, Andrew. I guess that means I did an all right job last week helping you get through this.
Yeah, well, you're holding the fort, really. Let's face it.
I nearly said holding the fort then, didn't I? But I think that's unfair. I don't want to take all the glory. You're the main man here.
Let's not sugarcoat it, James. We all know what we're doing here.
Well, I'm just here to make sure we say everything we're supposed to say.
That's it.
For anyone who isn't aware or didn't listen to last week's episode, the first episode of season 2.
You should go back and listen to that, because that is really important. Stop now and go back and listen to that one, and then you can start this one again.
If you missed it for whatever reason, I'm James. I am the captain here at One Fine Play, who are the podcast production company for The Invisible Gift. Mm-hmm. And in season 1, I think it's fair to say we had some challenges around intros and outros just because of your dyslexia and the need to be able to read a script. I guess some people don't realize how podcasting is produced.
No, I certainly didn't. And it was hit. You gave it to me right at the end when I thought we was finished. And I was like, oh no, I've got to do these intros and outros. And I thought I could get one of those funny voice guys come on like, hello and welcome to the show.
Well, that was an option, but you've ended up with me instead. So what we're alluding to is the idea that for most podcasts, the interview is recorded with a guest and then there's some editorial done. We cut out the fat so that the listening audience hear a highlight reel of the conversation rather than every last thing that was said. And after we do that, we go back and we record a section at the beginning and a section at the end, which we lovingly refer to as an intro and an outro, which is what we're doing now. And for most people, they can read a script, but because of your dyslexia, that's a little more challenging. So I'm basically your prompt.
Yeah, and what a helpful prompt you are.
Well, thank you so much. If you want to hear how it was recorded in season 1, we actually dropped in some outtakes from the way we did season 1. No one wanted to go through that again, so you've got to put up with our informal conversations at the beginning and the end of every episode.
That's it. And if you listen to this and you haven't heard it, then you didn't listen to me earlier. You still got to go back and listen to that first one. It's really important.
Also last week, we had Cara Toynton on the show, the Strictly Come Dancing winner, and I guess also known for her role in the BBC soap opera EastEnders.
Yes.
You had a fantastic conversation about the documentary that she made a few years ago.
There's so much on it, guys, and you've got to go back and listen to it. And then let me know, once you're done, let me know how it was and what you liked and any questions you have.
So on to the business of the day. For this week's episode, you sat down with no other than resident Blue Peter vet and star of the CBBC show The Pet Factor, Rory the Vet Cowlam.
Rory, what a gent.
He is a phenomenal guy. Having met him, I have to say he was just such an easy guy to warm to so quickly.
Yeah, I've met lots of people and I've never met anyone that walks in a room and has everyone instantly on their side like Rory. Incredible guy.
And as you're going to hear coming up, he has achieved some phenomenal things despite his dyslexia. He's really a beacon of how you can use dyslexia to achieve incredible things as a superpower, really. You guys talk about why he became a vet, his techniques for recording lines, which is something you also talked to Cara about.
Yeah.
So now you've had advice from two people about recording lines. I'm expecting big things when I...
We're expecting you not to be in next week's podcast.
Well, exactly. Maybe that'll happen. So if I'm not here next week, then...
Then I've listened to what they said.
You also talk a little bit about why mental health is the dirty little secret of the veterinary profession, which sounds interesting. But first off, I think you guys, as you tend to do in these conversations, kicked off talking about how Rory first discovered he was dyslexic.
Yeah, I mean, we're not origin sort of story people, but it is always great to start when you first find out the dreaded word dyslexia, and we've gone from there. But Rory, as you can see, achieved unbelievable things, and I think everyone listening could, even just knowing he's a vet, is like, whoa, because as a dyslexic person, academia isn't what you think is going to be the easy journey, and to become a vet, you need to be academic, and he's really smashed that.
Let's jump into it, shall we?
Let's have a listen.
So, Rory, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's going to be really interesting. We haven't had a vet before on the show, so... For me, the first question that I always like to ask people is, when did you discover that you had dyslexia?
I think there's almost a double-barreled answer for this, because there's when you start to assume and start to suspect, at least there was for me, and then there was actually when I got my diagnosis. So when I was actually at primary school, the first person to ever suggest to me and my parents that I was possibly dyslexic was my teacher, Mrs. Pruitt, and she was an absolute hero. You know that teacher at school you have that little affinity with?
Yeah.
She was that teacher, and... She pulled my parents aside, but I was probably only like 8 or 9. And she said, he's different. I don't know why, but he's different. He could be dyslexic. He could be ADHD. He's some sort of neurodiverse. I don't think she used the word neurodiverse. I don't think it was knocking around in the 90s. But and so she sort of raised it to my parents at that point. And then I actually got my proper diagnosis when I went to university. So yeah, 10 years later. So it's quite a while later. But yeah, it was my
How
first year.
How did they diagnose it at university?
So university actually paid for my test, for my dyslexia test. Because that was always the issue. My mum always wanted to get me tested. She was super suspicious that I was. She knew that it would sort of help me understand how my brain worked. I'd struggled in certain subjects and stuff, as I think a lot of us do.
Hmm.
But the test was like £500. And 500 quid to us was a lot of money.
Wow.
A lot of money. And so mum decided that it wasn't possible. And actually, she'd better be spending some money in trying to help me and support me herself.
Hmm.
And then I got to university, and it just so happened that the Royal Veterinary College decided they would pay for a test for me. And it came back that I was the most dyslexic person on the planet. No, not quite, but close.
I thought I was. That's really mad, because... Now, I might be really ignorant here, but isn't becoming a vet one of the hardest things you could do at university?
Yes. It's tricky. It is a lot of work. It's a lot of study time. And it's definitely stuff that doesn't cater to dyslexics, 100%. I actually don't think I've ever said this in the media or the public eye before, but I was in a group called the Apricots at university, which actually, as it turns out, once we all started to get our tests, was a group of dyslexics.
Okay.
But we were sort of labelled the Apricots because we struggled with the exams. And I really did struggle through university, don't get me wrong. Like, it wasn't
easy. Why the Apricots?
Oh, God, you know, some sort of term that sort of meant we were a little bit...
Because I never knew, I didn't know where you were going to go with that one, if I was honest.
I think it was like, some generic term.
Which way is he going?
It wasn't derogatory, but also a bit like, oh, the Apricots.
Yeah.
Look at them. So yeah, it was a group basically of dyslexia. And yeah, I did struggle through veterinary. I really did. But the thing I think that any dyslexic going through a very academic route will tell you is, there are ways to get around it. There are ways to adjust your study. And I think if you learn that while you're on that journey, you will get through it. And then once you're there, it's a bit like your driving test, isn't it? Mm. You learn how to pass your driving test, and then you learn how to drive.
Yeah,
And driving's way easier than learning how to pass your test.
Yeah, it is. So what did you do? That's interesting, because I still struggle getting over that point. I'm going through my chartership for my engineering at the moment. And it's really funny. I've forgotten what the educational side of stuff is, but I'm doing something called a technical report route now. And I sat down and started it the other day, and it was like,
Right. So first of all, write your synopsis. I can't even say the word. So that's how bad it is. Your synopsis. That's it. I see. I can't even say the word. So he said, write that. And I looked and I was like, oh, and it kind of transported me right back to how I was at school. So what did you do that was slightly different?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I think it's so trial and error. And through school, and I don't know about you, I didn't really get much help or get talked to about the different ways to study. So a lot of it came from my amazing mum, who basically committed her years while I was at secondary school to learning about dyslexia and learning how to help me the best she could. So she got me coloured paper, she got me coloured glasses, she got me tools for my laptop to help with voice recording versus sort of typing and versus handwriting. And sort of we went through all these iterations of different ways of learning and different ways of putting word to paper.
Yeah.
And I just worked out what worked for me and how best to do it. So I'm a big fan of spider diagrams. Spider diagrams for me are everything, because I'm so visual. I'm so visual. And I, through university, I used to get A3 pieces of paper and spider diagram everything, a whole topic. And then I used to have to handwrite in pencil only. I'm quite weird.
No, I only use pencils.
Right, because it feels better.
Yeah.
It's all about the feel. Yeah. And when you feel it, and you can't explain it, can you?
I have to have, and I'm sure lots of people like this, but I have to have a thick amount of paper as well. I can't have thin paper.
Absolutely, because it's too scratchy.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. So I had a leather padded back that I put behind a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And that provided the nice surface. I'd have to have a wrist rest for me. I looked like such a geek at school, honestly. I used to set myself up in the library and I used to look at it and go, oh my God, you look like such an idiot. But I had a wrist rest. I had to have my mechanical pencil.
Yeah.
And because otherwise it gets too blunt too quickly.
Yeah.
Can't have that. And I had to write it on lined paper in an A5 moleskin textbook.
Yeah.
Because it had to be neat and tidy. And that is how it worked for me. And I used to condense all my notes into like two pages of A5 and an A3 mind map. And that was how I revised. And that's how I went over things.
You said about your mum and how amazing she was. And everyone I meet has someone in their life, a mum or a dad, and predominantly a mum, that has been absolutely incredible. And I think this is now what I see pressure puts on top of parents when their kids are dyslexic. And the problem is, was your mum dyslexic?
She thinks she never got tested.
Right.
But she thinks she was.
Because a lot of mums I've spoken to since the podcast went out, the first season went out, they say they don't know how to deal with dyslexia, even though they can read about it, because they're normally dyslexic themselves. And there's always that, there's that barrier that they're not sure how to deal with that. But your mum, like so many people I've spoken to, has been incredible and probably wouldn't be where you were now if it wasn't for her.
You're so right. And it's really interesting because I think mum understood me. Even when I was a really young kid and all the way through my teens, me and my mum were super, super close. And that's not to say I wasn't with my dad, but me and my mum were thick as thieves. And we finished each other's sentences. It would be, where's the thingamajiggy? And, or do that. Or just completely generic sentences. And we just know what each other meant. Mm. And I think it is because she is probably dyslexic. And looking at how she writes, and now I sort of see myself in her now being older and being able to do that. I think she definitely is dyslexic. And I think that is why we always had an affinity. Interestingly, when I got my dyslexia report done officially through university, I got the report and I sent it home to my dad. And my dad read it, and I will never forget. He called me after reading it, and he'd read it twice back to back. And he just said, I'm so sorry. I get it. Mm. I understand. Because he used to get frustrated with me. He used to get frustrated that I wouldn't pay attention, or I'd be a bit disruptive, or I'd be doing 17 different things at once and really badly.
Yeah.
And he didn't understand it because he's so totally not that. And he called me and he apologized and he was like, look, I get it now. I understand. The next time I was home, we sat down, we had a beer and we went through it. And he was like, okay, cool. I understand that now. Oh, I'll ask you to do something like this instead. And it was so refreshing and it's so amazing. So in his own way, actually, he was just as important in that as well. But yeah, you're so right. I think it's really important for dyslexic kids particularly to have a really supportive person or network, because otherwise, I mean, I'm ranting now, but actually, if you look at some statistics,
yeah,
it's far more likely for a neurodiverse person to leave home as a child, to run away. Mm. It's also far more likely for a neurodiverse person to end up on the street.
Mm.
And I'm very much speculating because obviously there's no proof to this, but I think it's probably those neurodiverse people who are labeled disruptive in school.
Mm.
They don't have that support person. And I think we may be lucky and had that. Mm. Those people that don't have that, they're labeled disruptive at school. They're the naughty kid. The parents don't understand, so they shout at them.
Yeah.
They don't get on with kids of their own age because they're different. And so all those things go against them. And actually, that statistics are starting to show that's how those people are ending up in issues.
But do you not think that stems from the way the educational system views intellect is pretty old-fashioned? And that's what I find the problem is. Speaking to a lot of people in the education system, they said the problem is the education is so big, vast, to make them changes that are necessary, it's going to take a long time and probably way longer than we are all going to be around for it to solve itself, because it's taken so long to get where we are now. They're only now taking on new techniques for that.
Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about dyslexia, right? But if you look at all different neurodiversities, how do you cater for kids with all of those through this education system? You just can't. Mm. There isn't the funding. Teachers get a bad rap with dyslexia and bad rap with neurodiversity, but you cannot blame them, because how are they meant to work as hard as they do to teach as many kids as they do and cater their teaching? It's just not possible.
Well, that's what I've noticed from talking to people who went to private schools and state schools. State schools, you've got 30 to 32 people in a class. In private schools, you've got 15 people in a class. It's very, very, very different ability to teach in them classes. So you obviously went through your whole uni system and then went out, and after uni you went on and actually done TV work, didn't you?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a roller coaster the last 5 years. Couldn't have predicted it. The thing is, with veterinary, I knew I wanted to be a vet from the age of four. So,
oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's never been a question. It's always been veterinary, and I still meet people from my primary school years. Like, I'll go home and I'll bump into old school teachers or see my friends from like when I was 4, 5, 6 years old, and they'll go, "Oh, did you become a vet?" I'm like, "Yeah," but it was just never a question. It was always, "Yeah, I'm going to be a vet. I'm going to be a vet. I'm going to be a vet." And so, what was odd, and what was, I suppose, quite freeing, was the fact that when I got to 21 and I qualified as a vet and I started working as a vet, I could change my goal.
Yeah.
It had always been, I want to be a vet, but what's next?
Yeah.
And then I was very, very lucky to be recruited onto a children's television show. I did some social media stuff. And I think, again, I was quite lucky because I'm quite pro media and quite pro social media, because I think it's a really amazing opportunity to help educate and put yourself out there and tell your story and help people. And vets, as a general rule, hate being in front of the camera and hate talking out publicly.
Yeah.
Because as a group of people, we're usually quite introverted. We usually like speaking to animals rather than people.
Yeah.
And I completely blame my dyslexia for this. This is one of the reasons I call dyslexia my superpower, is because I'm different. I am not a normal vet.
No.
And I think anyone that sees what I do will think, oh, that's not how I see a vet. You're not a vet surgeon. You're not that James Herriot style, like loving the animals, a bit sort of geeky and quirky.
Yeah.
And I am completely geeky and quirky, but very extroverted with it as well.
Yeah.
And I completely blame my dyslexia for that, because it allows me to be emotive. It allows me to wear my heart on my sleeve. It allows me to portray myself in a different light and a very open light. And I think that's why I've then been lucky enough to then get involved with some media work.
The one thing for me is, whenever I speak to anyone that's in the public eye, does social media or presenting, the one thing I struggle with, now obviously there's probably different areas of dyslexia you struggle with, how do you do things like learning lines. Because I tell you what, when we finished last season's podcast, the end of the season, I have to do the intros. You notice I don't do much of an intro. When we sit down, we just start talking. And then I have to do the intros, and I'm done with James, who's the producer. And I can't do it. James had to read out the words, and I had to repeat them to try and say them, because when I read them out, I stuttered, I stopped. And it's not a confidence thing. It's just that my brain and my mouth doesn't seem to work together. So how did you go about dealing with that?
Yeah, you're so right. And that is classic dyslexia, because, I mean, we know dyslexia is a form of blindness, and it is about visual processing of words. So the fact that you were reading them off a piece of paper, there's your first mistake, mate.
Yeah.
I don't do that. I don't do that at all. So what I have to say it out loud first. So yeah. I have to have it played to me. And what the guys at True North do, who the production company that I do most of my filming with, they will, when I'm doing voiceover, for example, they record it in someone's voice at the tempo they want. And say, for example, okay, this dog called Archie came into the vets for a sore paw. And they'll record that. And I have to then, this dog called Archie came into the vets for a sore paw. This dog called Archie came into the vets for a sore paw. And almost say it until a point where I'm getting the rhythm, and then they hit record.
That's amazing.
And that is how I get the more complex. And then, I mean, that's something like that. It's quite simple. So I that would come very quickly. But sometimes they're wanting me to do 3 or 4 or 5 sentences back to back without stuttering or in a certain time frame or quicker or slower. And that is all about rhythm for me. And I will often just gently tap my foot to it, because if I can get into that rhythm, it helps.
What a great answer. I love that, because I've always wondered. And when I spoke to like Angela Marr, she said, I couldn't do it. So I end up just writing my own stuff. And I thought, and that's what I tend to do, or I will just go with the flow. It's like, I've asked a guy to come on the podcast and he said, what questions would you ask? And I'm like, I have no idea. I don't know what ways it's going to go, because I can't. I need to react off what the person's saying. And you can always tell how people are emphasizing things more when the way they move their eyes and arms and stuff like that. And I get that from people, but I can't pre-plan. I could give you questions, but there's no way them questions are going to be asked.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is the production company know that whenever they write me a line, it won't be perfect.
Yeah.
So I will always change a word or change the intonation or completely rewrite it myself in my head and just say that. And then I'll go, is that all right? And they go, yeah, that's fine. You got the gist.
Yeah.
So you just, I think if you try and stick to the script and stick to a form, you get in your head and you get panicky about it. Because also I get anxiety over it. And I'm sure you will too. Because you read a line, you're going, oh crap, okay, I'm not going to get this right. It's going to hurt. And then you get in your own head and then you stutter and you stumble. So if you go in going, okay, I've got to say something along those lines, all right, cool, blah, 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 then you're much more relaxed about it and it often comes out better.
So when I'd done the recording, I crushed my glasses case. I didn't even realise. I was sitting there so angry, and at the end of it I'd crushed my solid glasses case, and I was like, oh, that's just, I was getting so angry. And I mean, credit to James for being so patient with me.
Andrew, let's just jump in and have a quick check-in.
I really thought I'd done something wrong when you said that.
You haven't done anything wrong, but I can't believe you shared that story about crushing your glasses case.
Yeah, how embarrassing is that? It's not actually something I'm really proud of. I get mocked by Christina a lot about that.
But it got me a gig as a co-host, so...
Yeah. So it worked out well for you.
No, but it's really interesting to hear his stories about his frustrations with recording lines and the challenges that he's had, but also those really useful techniques for overcoming it.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear. The techniques are always different. Everyone we speak to, the techniques are different. I suppose that's really what we're coming down to, what you work, you do, what works best for you. And, you know, I think he's another level above most other people, the way he does things. And I'm going to go back and try his methods. Let's put it that way and see how that goes.
Well, hopefully as this season progresses, we will see if it works for you.
Yeah. And hopefully for you guys, I'll slowly get better at this.
And this is the point, according to my notes, at which you are supposed to plug the Invisible Gift podcast, which is a line that you in theory, could have learned in advance.
Yeah.
So let's give it a whirl.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is The Invisible Gift, the podcast about turning disability into possibility. Oh, come on, dude.
Absolutely smashed it.
Did I smash it? Oh!
Wow, I am... I'm getting a bit more nervous, if I'm honest, about not being...
Hi, everyone. I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness, and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
See you next week. Right, coming up, you guys talk about Rory's passion for mental health and his t-shirt.
Yeah, I try and make sure guests get... It's important that everyone gets the sort of messages they want across, and Rory's massive on mental health, and I think they go hand in hand with neurodiversity. And I think the way he done that with a t-shirt, a visual, and I'm a visual person, so that worked well. So he basically just sums up the t-shirt means, and he's so passionate about everything he does, and let's face it, there's not a hotter topic now than mental health.
Let's get back to it.
Let's get to it. So on the back of Mental Health Week, I think I didn't plan on saying this, but it's something I think is worth talking about, and given of the t-shirt you're wearing, it's okay to feel shit.
Yeah.
Can you explain the t-shirt? Because I think it's always good to get a good cause out. So
yeah.
Explain the t-shirt.
So this is a t-shirt from a charity called So Happy in Town. And they've produced these t-shirts saying it's okay to feel shit to help raise awareness and help raise money for youth mental health charities. Mm. We've all lived through this year and a half of crap, and mental health issues are on the rise. Everyone's living with that little black dog or some anxiety or something in their life that's a stressor, and even people that have never struggled with their mental health are really struggling this year. So I think now more than ever it's important that we are all grouped together, we all in the media as well, and in podcast form like this, we all say, look, it's okay. It is okay to feel like the way you're feeling. I have days where I can't be productive because I feel awful. And everyone has them. You're not on your own. It's the time to talk about it.
I think there's a lot of stigma around talking about this sort of things. And although your t-shirt says it's okay to feel shit, I've always said it's normal to feel shit. And I think the problem is we're so used to dressing everything up in the world we live in because of social media, which I love, but it's created a much larger community. But we all feel that we need to put our best face on, like they did way before we were born. But we used to have house parties and used to try and make sure you had the best food, and when all your friends come around you looked the best, everything was right and perfect. And now younger people live that day in and day out for their social media. And I think the second people talk about mental health, it looks like a weakness, and no one likes showing any weakness. And I think this comes on a lot to neurodiversity. I think from what I've been doing since season one is I've been reading posts that people put about neurodiversity, and not really reading the post itself, but looking at the comments, because that's what I'm interested in now, seeing the actual community that's hopefully listened to the podcast. And I've noticed the negativity around it is, and it shows the mental health issues with it, dealing with that. Do you think there's a mix between struggling that way and mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. I've just been nodding throughout everything you just said there, just waiting to champing at the bit. You're so right, and I completely agree. And Absolutely. So even going right back to kids at school age, if you're dyslexic, and whether you know or you're not, or you don't, I don't think it really matters, you're different. No one wants to be different at 12, 13, 14. When you're going through puberty, you want to be normal and you want to be the cool kid. You don't want to be different. I wanted to be different, but then that's different.
Yeah.
So you don't want to be different. You don't want to stand out. You want to be normal. And if you're dyslexic and you can't be, if you're ADHD, you do things and you're going, why did I just do that? Like that makes no sense, but it's just you and it's just the person you are. If you're different for whatever reason, you get picked on. It's the way it is. I was bullied at school. I'm sure a lot of dyslexics were bullied at school. And the thing is, if you are then labeled disruptive or the bad kid, that's a negative. That's already starting on a negative foot. And then you maybe don't do quite as well at school as everyone else and you're going, oh, that's negative. And then you don't get on the university course you want to go to, or you end up not doing the apprenticeship you want to do, or you end up not having a job out of school. And you're going, oh, that's negative as well. And there's always just that little bit of extra struggle just to put a dampener on it. And I absolutely think being neurodiverse in any way does unfortunately predispose you to being, well, to having mental health struggles. The other thing that we know about dyslexia particularly is that you wear your heart on your sleeve and you are super emotive on the, mostly, and I'm being very generic there because dyslexia comes in all different types, but usually you're very emotive, you're very heart on your sleeve and you get affected by things and you take things to heart. And as much as that's healthy and as much as that is often healthy processing of emotion, that is also not considered normal. And particularly as a man, that is, well, I was always told, oh no, come on, man up. Don't show that emotion. Don't process that. Just lock it down. You don't need to. Just go on, get on with it. And actually, that's so not the way to do it. You need to process emotion in any way you can. And I think as a dyslexic, being told to try and conform as a man, and particularly with male mental health issues, I think there is a huge link there. And just to also add in here, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the veterinary profession itself, veterinary has the highest rate of suicide of any profession in the modern industries.
No way.
Yeah. So we are, as vets, 4 times more likely than the average to commit suicide. We have almost the highest rate of depression. We have high rates of anxiety and burnout. We have huge numbers of people falling out of the profession. So mental health is a huge part of my life and something that I'm really keen on talking about because, again, within the veterinary profession, it's sort of the dirty little secret of the veterinary profession. And it needs to be spoken about and talked about to raise awareness.
Wow. That shocks me.
Cause there we go.
If you put me around animals all day, I think I'd be the happiest person in the world.
Well, there we go. But around healthy animals.
Healthy animals, yeah.
But
yeah,
you're speaking to people about euthanasia. You're making people upset. You're dealing with money concerns. You sometimes aren't given the opportunity to try and help these pets.
Yeah.
You're dealing with welfare concerns. Yeah. You're working long hours. You're not paid as much as the public think you are. I'm sure you will have an idea of what you think of a vet, and everyone thinks of the vet as, oh, they earn decent money, they drive the new car,
you're right, that's exactly when I think of a vet, I think loads of money,
yeah,
but they've worked, I always think they worked hard to get there, loads of money, and you just pointed out a fundamental flaw in my thinking, which I love that. I'm all about conversation, and I've just said something really stupid, but you rightly pointed out, I've gone, how could you be sad when you work with animals all day? But like you just said, it's not, you know, I'm not walking into a healthy animal place. It's all the sad parts of did. And anyone that becomes a vet obviously loves animals, right? So that's got to be hard.
Hugely empathetic people and huge amounts of compassion fatigue as well. So I'm using lots of buzzwords there, but it's...
passion
fatigue. Yeah, compassion fatigue. So yeah, when you're showing compassion day in, day out, every 20 minutes you're seeing a new person. And don't get me wrong, it could be someone with a brand new puppy and it's lovely and it's amazing and it's a really happy 20 minutes consult. But then you could be going from that consult to the next 20 minutes when you are having to put a 16-year-old dog down that these people have had since they were a puppy and you've got a whole family bawling their eyes out.
Yeah.
And then from there, you're then going back to another happy, and you're basically going from extremes of happiness to sadness to happiness to then emergency situations, high adrenaline pumping. Yeah. So you've got all these different things. And then going back to the money thing, the average wage for a vet in the UK is £38,000.
What?
Yeah. There you go.
Do you know what the average wage for a scaffolder is in the UK?
I'm sure it's more than 38,000.
47.
There we go.
Wow. Should have become a scaffolder.
I should. Okay, career change now. Wow. I'm out.
So when you do your presenting and a lot of TV work you do, how do you organise that? Are you a very organised... You actually, earlier on, you said you sounded very organised. Are you a very organised person? Because obviously there's different forms of dyslexia. So what's the things you actually struggle with in dyslexia?
So I suppose organisation is an interesting one, isn't it? I hate people saying, oh, I'm a bit OCD, because you're not OCD. OCD is a really serious condition.
Yeah.
And I always used to say, oh, I'm a bit OCD. No, I'm just a little bit obsessive about certain things. Mm. So my desk has to be organized at right angles. It has to be. Mm. And I have to have like pens, post-it notes, everything, laptop in the center, and it has to be perfect, because otherwise it distracts me from my work.
Yeah.
And these are all things I've learned over the years. And I used to try and work, for example, in the library with people walking around and people chatting. And it's like, that doesn't work. Mm. Actually, for me, the way I've always found it's worked for me is go to a cafe. I don't know anyone. Mm. I have to be somewhere that I don't know anyone. I can't get to know people, because otherwise I'll just chat. But I have to go in a cafe, a seat in the corner, laptop on, headphones in, music without lyrics, quite loud. Mm. And just work away. And I can probably work for 6 to 8 hours straight there.
Do you ever, you might be a bit too young for this because it was right on the edge of me. Do you remember a program called Cheers?
I've seen Cheers.
That's my worst nightmare. Where everybody knows your name.
Yeah.
No, not for me. I need to go places where nobody knows my name.
Yeah.
I completely agree. If I know people, because I'm chatty, that's it. So I avoid places. If I need time to think or do something, I would avoid. Although I always find a way to talk to anyone. So the best thing I can do is actually drive, because then I can't talk to anyone if I need to think.
Yeah.
But so a lot of people message me after season one, and this is an area out of all the questions I've been asked, this is the most common question. And you obviously do it because you talk about it a lot. At what point in your career did you feel that it was safe, you were safe to talk about your dyslexia in your career? Because most people are terrified of telling, and I mean seriously terrified of telling their boss or the people within their company that they're dyslexic, as if it's something that could get them potentially sacked or not promoted.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've not really... It's always been a subconscious thing for me. Mm. At uni, it was such an accepted thing that I got used to it at university about saying openly that I was dyslexic. And I think it wasn't used as an excuse. It wasn't used as a badge of honour. Mm. It was just one of those things. Because I think you've got quite a highly intelligent group of people studying veterinary. And I think, and I wouldn't know, I don't know the statistics on this, but I would think actually you've probably got a higher instance of things like neurodiversities at those sorts of courses. Mm. In the real world, as I call it, I'm not entirely sure I still feel comfortable.
Right.
I hope that we live in a society that accepts these things now, and doesn't look at you as dumb. And doesn't look at you as a bit thick if you're dyslexic, because that's essentially what you're worried about, right? Because they're the labels that are thrown around. And particularly when I was at school, if you were dyslexic, you were a bit thick, you're a bit slow, bit rubbish at maths, bit rubbish at English. And I think that's we have that deep-seated nervousness that that is going to be the assumption that your boss or your colleagues will make. Mm. I am still not 100% comfortable with it. I'm not entirely sure I've ever told my boss.
Mm.
In like face to face, obviously she'll know, but face to face, I'm not sure I've told her. But I always look at dyslexia as my superpower, and I have done since I was at uni, because as I've said to you, I think once you understand how your brain works, once you understand how you can make dyslexia work for you, once you realize that dyslexia doesn't mean it's negative, and actually, if anything, it opens up a whole new box for you. Like, if you think of your brain as boxed in, if you're dyslexic, you have got rooms after rooms after rooms of amazing abilities and ways of thinking outside the box and being creative and thinking completely different to the person sat across from you. So actually, the one thing I would say to people out there, if you are worried that your boss or your colleagues won't accept you for being dyslexic, you're not in the right job. Because you are not in the right position. You should be looked at as an asset, not as a hindrance.
I completely agree with all that. And I say to people, well, my answer is the same. You're in the wrong job. But that's normally the blanket answer I give, because there's a lot of people that would out there see it. But I also say, again, with everything in life, it's also not the person. You can't wait for other people to help you in life. So I said, I'd had this conversation with someone, and I said, the best way to put it is, I saw a video on Facebook years ago of a really overweight guy doing parkour. And he was flipping around, and no one that size should have been able to do what he'd done. And I always said, if you were to stand there and you had this competition where you had all these really healthy guys looking amazing, flipping around, and then he walked on, there would be an instant judgment. It'd be like the Susan Boyle of the moment. You know, you think it's going to be one way. And then he does all this amazing stuff, and he is incredible. And I said, the best thing I can say is, you know your weaknesses. And with everything in life, especially in business and work, you should know your weaknesses. Failures are a strength to have, because once you know them, you know where your strengths lie. So if you're going to tell your boss, or you feel like you need to tell your boss, and I don't think it's a bad thing, If you're going to get a promotion and they ask you, why do you think you should be promoted? By the way, I don't think anyone should ever ask that question. But if they did, you would list all your strengths, and they would say, well, what are your weaknesses? Is nearly every interviewer always asks you what your weaknesses are. And that the reason why they do that is because it is important for you to know your weaknesses, because your weak areas, you can get your team to help you, or you can, it can be shared around with other people. But when you know your weaknesses, it means you really know your strengths. And that is what you can play on. And that's why, if you know that, you're more of an asset than the people that sit there and don't know their strengths and weaknesses. And that is the message you've got to put across to your boss. I mean, for me, that's why I ask you, and I will ask everyone this season, I will ask that question too, because when someone asked me, I went, I'll just tell them. But I understand I am a lot more confident than most people. So if it's like I was brought in for one of my first company I ever worked for was struggling through the recession. And they said, we're going to have to let people go. And everyone had to come in and say why they shouldn't be let go, which is one of the worst things that can ever happen to anyone. And I walked in, I had only just started in the job, and they said to me, so why should we keep you on? And I went, dude, don't, it's up to you. And they went, what do you mean? What would be the reason for keeping us? I was like, I can walk out and get another job. You either want to keep me, I'm good at my job, or you don't want to keep me. Either way, it's up to you. I was like, I know my worth, you know my worth, I don't have to tell you. And I actually kept that job. But what I said is, I understand that everyone's not the same. And so when people ask me, I don't really know the right answer. I just can give the best bit of advice. But that's what I want to get your take on it.
Yeah. And I think this is the thing, isn't it? I think if you are dyslexic, you need to learn how that works for you and how that makes you different and how you can apply that to your industry. For me, in veterinary, it means that I can talk to people. It means that I can be emotive. It means that I can have more compassion. And they are absolutely my strengths within my industry. My weaknesses, I get a bit shitty in the afternoons because it drains me. And I am rubbish at note-taking because I just hate typing on a computer, and I'd much rather handwrite things. But also, I think the other thing, the interesting sort of converse to that question is, if you're a boss and you've got a dyslexic employee, what can you do to help? What should you be doing to support those people, because I think that is an appeal that we need to make as the dyslexic community to go, yeah, it's all great and well talking about dyslexics and how they see themselves and how they can do this and that, whatever. But what can non-dyslexic bosses or non-dyslexic people do to help and support their colleagues and employees?
Yeah, and that's probably quite a big thing to get into.
You're a boss.
Yeah, but then I find a lot of people I've spoken to who said they understand dyslexia who aren't dyslexic, I've always had a dyslexic boss.
Right.
And my team, I think, be the first to tell you, one of the guys that started working with me said, you are definitely the weirdest boss I've ever worked for, the most different, because where a lot of people put emphasis on the work, I put emphasis on team and environment and stuff like that, because if I get them all to work together, their weaknesses are irrelevant because they do everything together. So if you were a boss, what would you do?
Good question.
Seeing as I've just swerved that question.
You haven't, have you? No, it's good, because I think there's so many different things you could do. And I think you've got to, I mean, firstly, I'd ask people what they would want and what changes they could make to the office environment that you could do. And I think that's the thing. You've got to focus on, number one, I suppose, working times and working patterns. Hmm. I work in a very rigid working pattern. I work 11 hours a day and I have back-to-back consults, I have surgeries, and then I have back-to-back consults. So that for me doesn't work for my dyslexia. It really doesn't. It tires me out. I am knackered after a long day like that. Particularly as I quite often finish my day writing notes, catching up on admin.
Wow.
And honestly, that's the tough bit. And that's the back-ended part of the day. That just doesn't work for me. But I've made it work and I've got my ways to get around it. If there was a way of shifting all that admin and stuff right to the front of the day, or do two half days instead, or have another way of doing it, that would be great for me. So I think as a boss, you've got to be aware of those things, aware of what works with regards to timings. And then the other thing I'd love to see at work, we've got a lot of protocols printed and laminated and stuck on boards.
Yeah.
I was going to swear that. I hate it.
You're welcome to swear.
I fucking hate it. Yeah. And it's so... I mean, I get it. Don't get me wrong. Protocols need to be there. They need to be printed out. They need to be for all to see. But they're on white paper and they're laminated in a very white room. And honest to God, you might as well just put a blank piece of paper on the wall. I don't see that. I'm sure non-neurodiverse people don't see that.
Yeah.
So... simple things like using coloured paper, simple things like using coloured font or highlights, or going about daily meetings in person rather than email bulletins. And honestly, I hate the non-personal aspect of that sort of thing as well, because that 10 minutes it takes you to write that email and send it to everyone, just get them all in a room.
Yeah.
And again, that, I suppose that goes back to corporate size. So corporate companies, that's not really very easy, but if you're a small company, do it in a personal way. That's the beauty of being a small company.
Yeah. Well, so this is what I love about, like, James and Connor send me voice memos.
Yes.
Which everyone does, right? Because that is an amazing way to get through to me. And so I've got the team to start doing it now.
Yeah.
Which is really, really cool. And it doesn't need to be for everyone, but it's just what it suits and who it suits. But you say about printing off, we have a strict no printing policy in our office. And do you know what? Every time someone says something about printing, I'm just like, nope, it's against our environmental policy, and no one says anything.
Like it. Dyslexia policy.
Yeah, yeah. I just don't want things printed out. I mean, I suppose I don't like people printing things out anyway, but it's right. And I have this with emails. I mean, even my clients are learning this now. If you send me an email with lots of paragraphs, I'm not even going to read it. My brain just doesn't work like that. So bullet points. It has to be bullet points. And I will read every bullet point and then I'll probably get it. I mean, I lean heavily on my PA, because, like, on my way here, I record a load of notes, and obviously the team puts notes about you and the people I'm speaking to, and I get on my journey here, which takes me an hour. They sit there and run through everything, and talk to me about the people I'm speaking to. And the reason why is because I read that 20 times the other day, and it doesn't go in. It was only until she said it to me that I got it. Yeah, so that's one. I suppose that's the way we communicate needs to change a lot.
I think it does, or not necessarily change. I think it just needs to be open to change.
Yeah.
I think being stuck in the technical age of emails and Slack. Oh my God, don't get me started on Slack. Jesus Christ.
I used to love Slack, but I've now, saying that Teams is pretty much the same.
Well, right. I mean, I get so lost. I really do. And it's just words. And yeah, so anyway, I think being in the technical age, we're so lucky to have so many different resources at our disposal. I think finding what works for different people, what works for your team. And as a boss, just be open to that change. Don't make people work the way you're working. Make people work the way they work, and you'll find productivity just soars.
So you've written a book.
Yeah, the dyslexic kid writes a book. There's a turnout for the press, isn't it?
So what's the name of your book?
Yeah, I should have said that, really. Yeah. It's The Secret Life of a Vet, because it's all about it's about being a vet, and it's about who we are and my journey through it. But it's also about being dyslexic. It's also about the mental health struggles through the profession and a few of the things you don't think about when you think about your vet.
How'd you do that as a dyslexic?
With difficulty. It was the biggest challenge I've taken on since leaving uni, honestly, because it was so against everything that I struggled. It was so everything I struggled with. I am king of last minute. So you give me a deadline, I'll do it the day before.
Yeah.
Turns out you can't do that with 80,000 words. it takes quite a few weeks to do 80,000 words. So I knew I was writing a book as of February 2019. Yeah. February 2019. My deadline was March 2020. I wrote it in February 2020.
Hmm.
Between February of 2019 and the end of 2019, I did about 10,000 words. So I did basically 90% of the work in the last month. The writing of it, I think uni really helped with it, and particularly having done quite a big uni course with lots of wordy essays and stuff, I'd learned over the years how to go about that. So I have it depends on what mood I'm in, firstly, but I have to break down my work into 20-minute chunks.
Right.
And sometimes if I'm feeling good, I'll do two back-to-back, but it's usually 20 minutes, 5 minutes off, 20 minutes, 5 minutes off, because my attention span is 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think that there is and I can't remember the theory, that the person that came up with this theory, but there is a genuine scientific reason for it, of a 20-minute working span. And it doesn't work for all people, but for me particularly, 20 minutes, I can be super productive. I know I've got a break on the horizon, because 20 minutes is 20 minutes. And I don't find myself dreaming about 6 hours' time when I can go to the pub.
Yeah.
I don't find myself thinking, oh, this is really dull. I just absolutely smash 20 minutes and then I take a step away.
Yeah.
And then I go back to it, another 20 minutes, take a step away. And I find my productivity in that way. Number one, I can produce more in those 20 minutes than I can in an hour usually, but I can also work for 8 hours straight rather than having to stop every 2 hours or so.
Yeah.
So that for me was a big working tool. I did do it all on laptop, which, to be honest, I kind of wish I hadn't. I kind of wish I'd handwritten it.
And it's because they're typewriting, but
that I wish I'd done. That would be very cool, wouldn't it? It's like cigar, glass of red wine, typewriter. But I did it on laptop, and I think that probably went against me. I think that probably played into my weaknesses, to be honest, because I was looking at a screen, and I a lot of it I actually wrote with the screen on like the minimum brightness I physically could, because I didn't actually read it. I just typed it, and then the amount of mistakes I made was unbelievable. But yeah, 80,000 words is a lot of words, and I found myself repeating myself. I had to go back. I had to break it down into chunks. I had to write, say, okay, today I'm going to do 2,500 words for this chapter, and that would be my task. And so it was a real big challenge, but I'm so proud of myself for doing it, because it was so, as I said, not something that I would necessarily call my strength. The other person I absolutely have to shout out is my other half, Rihanna, because she is a tutor, and she is particularly an essay editor tutor.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, great. Some people did wonder whether I just started going out with her because I knew I was going to write a book, but I promise her that we're still on. She helped Hugely. And again, going back to support network, right?
Yeah.
If you've got someone in your corner, even if you're doing something you're not great at, they're going to help and it'll make it a lot easier.
So you said earlier about your superpower, or seeing as this is the name of the show, your invisible gift. So what would you say your, what would, how you describe your invisible gift?
Yeah, so as I said, I mean, dyslexia is my superpower. It's always been what I've called my superpower. And I think whoever you are, whatever neurodiversity you've got, that is the one thing you've got to remember. Yes, you might be right at the start of your journey. You might just have got your diagnosis. You might be labeled the thick kid. You might be super negative about this. And you might be listening to this for the first time. This might be the first time you've heard dyslexia or whatever neurodiversity spoken about in a positive light. You've got to remember there's other people out there. You've got to remember that they genuinely are some of the most creative, entrepreneurial, wealthy, incredible people out there. Just because you are dyslexic and you've got this label does not mean you are not worth the same as non-neurodiverse people. It took me a while to work out why dyslexia was a positive and how I could see dyslexia as a positive. And sometimes, I can go right back there and I can go, oh God, I was so negative about the whole thing. I was embarrassed. I felt thick. I felt a bit stupid. But you have to see a way through it. You have to work out how your brain works. And there's some amazing books out there, which is really ironic because quite often dyslexics don't like reading and there's books about dyslexia and how you can make it work. So podcasts, listen to podcasts. But you have to just take a step back, learn how your brain works. Just because other people are doing something, there's always pressure to sit and work for 8 hours straight. You don't have to. You really don't. I've never found that helps me. And people used to think I was super lazy because I used to go into the library for half an hour and then leave. But that, if that's what works for you, you are an individual. And if that's how your brain works, that's how your brain works. You can't change that. So embrace it, call it your superpower, and yeah, you will be a lot happier for it, and make it work for you.
That's great. Thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been amazing.
Thank you.
James, that bit at the end where he said about dyslexia being his superpower and how you embrace it and it will make you happier, it's kind of defines what this podcast is about and the reason why I started it in the first place.
Yeah, to me, it's the essence of the show.
It's just so typical for Rory that he would wrap both mental health and dyslexia in one package, because that's what it ultimately means. It's two important things put together.
Yeah, and the intersection of where those two things meet is essentially how he approaches the whole topic of neurodiversity.
And I think it's reflected in his happiness, because he is a happy guy. You know, it's funny, he works with animals, yet generally he's like when you meet a dog for the first time. Do you know how happy you are when you first see a dog? You're like, wow. He's like that. He's
I can't
got that.
Wait for you to talk your way out of this one. You've just referred to your guest as talking to a dog.
Yeah, but for a vet, he'd probably find that as a compliment, because if someone said I'm like that, I would as well.
I also found it really interesting how he talked about the challenges in the veterinary profession around the lack of pay and the mental health challenges.
That is, he smashed a myth there about vets that I think most people, I guarantee everyone listening to this, you guys are going to be as shocked as I am, because there's a few things that we assume about vets. One, they're paid a lot of money. Two, they're the happiest people in the world because they're always spending all their time with animals. And he's just... when he told us all that, it's like, what? Why do we keep on buying into this rhetoric?
My girlfriend is a doctor, works in the NHS.
Oh,
and yeah, that shattered a lot of illusions for me about, you know, they get paid and they're super happy because they're doing something so valuable. And I see the day-to-day grind that they go through, and I just never really connected it to vets, but it seems like a really similar challenge.
I mean, I suppose the way he explains it in the podcast is so true. It's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure. And when you love the thing you're working on, and sometimes you have to go through the stages of losing that, like being a vet or a doctor, it must be really hard, because ultimately you do that job to save lives and make people's lives better.
I also thought it was interesting what he said about coming out as dyslexic and how he still struggles with it and he's not fully comfortable with it.
Which surprised me because he's so overtly confident.
I don't think he's even told his boss, has he?
No. And that
he has now.
Well, yeah. He hasn't in so many words, but this is the thing we all struggle with. You know, you can say something and you think it's going to be really great. And it can go the other way because you're just assuming that you understand the person you're talking to understands your position. And look, we all like to think we've got empathy, but sometimes it's just not there.
What do you think of his undertaking of writing a book?
Well, that made me jealous. I love to be jealous. I love people succeeding more than me. I think it's great. As you know, James, because I spoke to you about it when we first spoke about the podcast, is the book is something I want to do. And hearing how he went about that was quite inspirational for me. And I'm not just saying that because it's a buzzy little word, but it was really interesting hearing how he went about that.
Fascinating. I guess we might as well tease at this point that later in the season, we have an author coming on the show, an award-winning author at that. I guess you're excited to sit down and talk to someone who has written multiple books.
Yeah, I've been so excited about that and I can't wait to pick her brains.
Andrew, it's that time of the week that I earn my pennies for being here. I've got some notes to read us through. First off, make sure you check out Rory's book, The Secret Life of a Vet. We will link to it in the show notes. And you can also follow him on Instagram at Rory the Vet. Andrew, I know it means a lot to you to hear from the listeners of this show. We have an email inbox that people can share their stories with. I know that you'd love to hear about their neurodiversities, their challenges, how they use dyslexia as a gift, their thoughts on the show, their feedback, their comments. What's the email address they should be using?
So guys, if you want to send me an email, my email address is andrew@theinvisiblegift.com. And it's really important for you guys to get in contact and tell me your stories and your experiences and any questions you want to ask the people that we chat to on the show, because it's a community effort and, you know, everyone's experiences are different.
There's a website for the podcast, which is at www.theinvisiblegift.com. And you can find us on Instagram at The Invisible Gift.
Yep.
According to my notes, Andrew, the next guest on the show is Tanya Bardsley, best known for her work in The Real Housewives of Cheshire.
Yeah, it's super exciting to have Tanya on the show.
That's a real scoop for the show. And Connor, the producer, has done a fantastic job landing that.
Yeah, what a legend. I didn't have words when he told me that she was coming on the show. I was like, wow.
Well, that episode is being recorded this week and will be out next week.
Next week, yeah.
Fantastic.
Make sure you guys listen.
Andrew, that's probably about it for this week.
It is indeed. And what a great week it's been.
Thank you for having me back. Hopefully you'll have me next week.
And thank you for being my prompter. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. You've been listening to the Invisible Gift podcast presented by me, Andrew Kitley. And produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.